Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lowell.
Well, thank you for the lovely introduction and the nice welcome. It's an incredible privilege visiting a community where a talk on the quantum structure of space and time fills an audience of this size. Wow. So it will be my task for the next hour to give you my view on space and time and the microstructure of it. And, well, as any good lecturer, I give you the punchline to start with so you can nod off happily. So basically, I'll be treating kind of three different subjects here. First, I'll start to explain to you why we physicists are so interested in space and time, in empty space and time, in nothing really. So what's so fascinating about this? Then I will try to explain a bit that if you're really interested in kind of getting a handle on space and time, possibly manipulating space and time, you actually need to understand the quantum structure that underlies kind of the classical space and time we are surrounded by. And we'll also, as part of this adventure, we'll take a trip down the wormhole, as you'll see. And then I'll also tell you how much we actually know about the quantum structure of space and time and what we can actually hope to understand. Now, I always like, as a warm-up, to start kind of outlining the vastness of physical scales we are interested in physics, and then more specifically, kind of what I'll be zooming in on tonight. Now here, you see this yellow line. It gives the range of scales we are typically interested in physics. Now, in order to fit it all on one line, we use a special scale which is given in powers of 10. So what does that mean? If I advance kind of one little unit along this scale, I always multiply by a factor of 10. And you could imagine, you know, sitting there with your microscope, you turn up the resolution by another factor of 10, by another factor of 10. So now if you look at our entire universe, the phenomena we'd be interested in would be ranging from all the way from 10 to the 26 meters, and I've spelled it out for you there. It's the one with 26 zeros behind, and that in meters, all the way down around 1 meter, that is 10 to the zero, to incredibly small units where you subdivide 1 meter, and you get to units. The minimal unit we are usually looking at is 10 to the minus 35 meters, and there you have a zero dot, and then you have 34 zeros and 1 1. So this is kind of the vastness of physical scales we are interested in. Now, physics, or what we're interested in physics, can often be characterized by a specific scale we're looking at. So a specific scale is associated with specific physical phenomena, and there are sets of laws that are adapted to that scale and which we want to describe. So what characterizes the biggest scale of 10 to the minus 26 meters? It's the scale of our visible universe. So that's kind of as far as we can ever hope to look with our eyes, with our instruments. And what you see there on the far right at the top is just a picture, a rendering of the cosmic microwave background. Now, you go to somewhat smaller scales, then of course you see all the galactic kind of the phenomena we see in our universe, astrophysical ones. So you go through kind of spiral galaxies, smaller galaxies, and all the way to you come to the size of the solar system, our own Earth, and down there that's us, 10 to the zero meters, that cute little baby. And then we go to the centimeter, millimeter scale, and then we come at about 10 to the minus 10 meters. That's the scale of atoms. Atoms, of course, have a substructure, so you zoom in onto the nucleus of the atom and the particles that make up the nucleus, then you get to the structure of kind of protons, neutrons, as illustrated here, and their constituents, which are quarks and gluons that bind them together. And to about 10 to the minus 19 meters, reaches a scale which we can probe directly with our most powerful particle accelerators, like the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, that's being built in Switzerland currently. Now, what I'm interested in is yet far beyond that scale. That's the so-called Planck scale, and what happens there. So that's really the scale of 10 to the minus 35 meters. You could also characterize it as a scale for which you still can apply for funding. With your average funding agency. So that's really what I'm interested in. Now, to rephrase the question about what happens on very short scales, you could say, well, if I know roughly what the world of my elementary particles is about, this is very well described by the so-called standard model. Now, I could kind of zoom in there with my microscope, and I could really ask, now, what's in the empty space in between those elementary particles? Is there nothing? Or is there a structure still? Is there something? I mean, there must be something. I mean, the nothing is also for us physicists is an anathema. So what is there? And we already really know from good old 20th century physics that, well, nothing, kind of empty space, contains much more than meets the eye, even if you don't go quite to as small scales as I want to do today. So this nothingness is known to have already an intricate and interesting structure from the point of view of both quantum theory and the theory of space and time. Now, of course, again, to claim to be doing, to be working on the structure of nothing doesn't quite sound so fancy. So, of course, we immediately give this a much better sounding name. We call this the vacuum. Now, we study the structure of the vacuum. And as part of that, and to give you a kind of a review of how our understanding of empty space and time has developed, I give you a very condensed introduction of space and time, empty space and time. And it's really the briefest history you'll get anywhere. So we are hot in pursuit of a theory describing the quantum structure of that empty space-time. And again, what we believe is behind this, I mean, the theory that should describe it on these smaller scales will be a theory of quantum gravity. Now, how come quantum and how come gravity? I mean, I was just talking about space and time. How are these things connected? Okay, let us backtrack a little bit to the world of classical physics. So this is the world of Newton, and really the world of classical mechanics, and it very much accords also with our intuitive view of what space and time is all about. So here you see Newton, and well, the great thing, one of the many great things that Newton realized was that there is a connection between the apple falling from the tree, so what makes the earth attract the apple so it falls down, and what's behind a planet, like the moon, surrounding the Earth. So what the two things that are kept together in orbit, both of these happen through kind of gravitational forces that act between all objects that have a mass. So here it's the Earth attracting the apple, and really the very same fundamental laws underlie the motion of the moon around the Earth. Now, what was Newton's worldview, and what was the prevalent worldview, also within physics, for many hundred years following Newton? Well, the universe is made up of space and time. Space is just there. It's like a continuum. It just happens to be there. It just sits there like a big vessel or a stage. And whatever ever interesting phenomena there are in physics, like gravitational attraction, happens in that space. But space itself doesn't take part in the action. Time is something that's separate from space. Time is a universal clock that just ticks away for every observer, no matter where they are, no matter how fast they move. This is kind of the universal time of classical physics. And then there is yet something completely different apart from these two aspects of nature, which is gravity, the gravitational laws that describe the phenomena I just described. So what is important to remember here is really that space and time, they're just there, they're universal, they're forever unchanging. Now, this changed very radically in the last century with what I'll call Einstein's double revolution. Now, the first part of the revolution goes back to 1905. And deliberately, I've chosen here a picture of Einstein as he was then. He was 26 years old when he came up with the theory of special relativity. Now, what does that say? It says, well, you cannot really consider space and time as two phenomena that have nothing to do with each other. On the contrary, you cannot draw a sharp distinction between what is time and what is space. What's the ultimate reason for that? The ultimate reason is really that the speed of light is constant and finite. Now, what does it immediately imply? This seemingly, well, trivial, banal observation. It implies that two observers will, in general, not agree on what it means for two things to have happened simultaneously. Because imagine, you know, you have like two light bulbs, you stand in the middle of the two light bulbs, they go on at the same time. Now, for you, well, you see them as going, lighting up at the same time. But for an observer who stands over there, she will see that light bulb lighting up slightly earlier because the light has had to travel a shorter distance to her than the light coming from that lamp. So already, the two of us will not, even if it's just a tiny, tiny difference, not agree on what it was that happened simultaneously. And if you spin this further, well, you come to the conclusion that you have to talk about space-time, a four-dimensional entity that contains both space and time. On the other hand, another aspect has not very much changed compared to the Newtonian point of view. Namely, this is still a kind of an unchanging entity. Now, you don't have separate space and time. You have one space-time, but again, it's something that just sits there. It's a stage, and it doesn't take part in the dynamics of the theory of physical phenomena. Now, this changed very, very radically with the advent of so-called general relativity in 1915. Now, we see a still very youngish-looking Einstein. His tongue is still where it ought to be, very ordered hairstyle. And one should, of course, also say, you see, the age at which he came up, say, with the theory of special relativity, that is like, you know, in nowadays terminology, during his first postdoc. And his amazing physics, for part of which he was awarded a Nobel Prize later, what he did in that year. Now, what is general relativity all about? It takes a radically new and different view of space and time. Now, it unifies space-time and gravity. What it, in fact, says is that there is space-time comes with a structure. The structure we call curvature, and that structure is a local structure, so it can change from point to point in space and time, and we feel the structure as gravitational forces. So we encode gravitational forces that massive objects with mass and energy exert on each other, we encode those in the structure of space-time itself. Now, why can one do this? One can do it because gravity is universal. So nothing and no one can escape the forces of gravity. You cannot shield yourself away from gravity. So there's no escape. So if you have a mass or an energy, then you will exert gravitational forces on your surroundings. And conversely, whatever is in your surroundings and has mass or energy will exert gravitational forces, gravitational pull on you. And since it happens for everything and everyone in the same way, you can ascribe this property to space-time. And what you say is, well, space-time, therefore, is not just a structureless continuum that just sits there and doesn't do anything, but it itself becomes kind of the actor. It's no longer just the stage on which things happen, but it becomes part of the physical dynamics, the physical process. Now, is this all just academic ideas? No, the real world really seems to be like that. So how do we know, how do we understand that our very own space-time, space and time, is curved and not just flat and structureless? Well, you start with a little exercise. We'll come back to that also later. Imagine now, for the purpose of illustration, you are a two-dimensional being. So you're a little ant, but you're flat. So you cannot see the third dimension. You live on this two-dimensional surface. Now, how can you distinguish between sitting on a flat surface, two-dimensional, like a two-dimensional sheet of paper, and on the surface of a round sphere? By not stepping outside into the third dimension and seeing, aha, well, this is a sphere. Now, how can you, when you're just living inside this two-dimensional surface, how can you make measurements that would tell you, aha, I must be sitting on a curved space? It's very straightforward, really. You draw a large triangle, like indicated here. So you connect three edges by straight lines. And then you go away and measure the angles between each pair of lines. And if those all add up to 180 degrees for each triangle you can draw in the space, then you can be sure that you're sitting on a flat space. So that's the picture on the left. However, the result is different when you're sitting on a sphere, because then the angles will be larger than 60 degrees each. And then that's, you can recognize, just by making measurements within that space, being that little ant in two-dimensional flatland, you can conclude that you're sitting in a curved space. In the very same way, it works in our own four-dimensional space-time. By just making measurements of length and sending light rays and see how long they travel in their straight lines, we can come to similar conclusions. And this picture here on the right illustrates this effect, again, in a kind of cartoon-like way, reducing everything to two dimensions. So what you see here on the right is kind of an image, an artist's image, of deformed space-time through the presence of a very heavy object, say a heavy star. So this object sits there in the center. It curves space and time. And as a result, any object that could be a comet or, in this case, a light ray that passes close to it will deviate from its straight path. And the result you get here is something one calls a gravitational lens. So actually, the situation that's depicted there is, imagine you have a very bright object that sits somewhere in the universe, and the light reaches your eye from very far away. Now imagine that there is a very heavy object somewhere on the way in that path of light, say a heavy galaxy. Now what will happen is that the light rays that come from that bright object will get focused around this heavy galaxy, and they will appear to your eye as coming from different locations. And this is exactly kind of what's drawn in this picture there on the right as image one and image two. And this is not just mere theory. Down there, you see a picture taken by the Hubble telescope of a gravitational lens. Well, it's a specific gun. It has a name, some code name there. And what it is, it's really light of a quasar that is 8 billion light years away from us, and it's being focused by a galaxy that sits in between the lightway, the pathway of the light. And you see multiple images, and of course the geometry of these images depends on the mass distribution and the shape of this intermittent galaxy. But here you see directly gravitational forces at play and how they can be translated in curvature of space-time. So curved space-time geometry is being reinterpreted as gravitational force. So this brings me kind of to the end, kind of the first part of my talk, which is, let us summarize. So we've discovered that empty space and time is actually an entity that's of intrinsic interest to us, especially to us physicists, because it has intricate local properties, and we can probe these properties, for example, by traveling light rays or studying objects that move in such a curved background. Now, how a piece of space-time curves and moves depends, of course, on what kind of objects, massive and energetic objects, sit in it and where they sit in it. And it is described quantitatively by the equations of the classical theory of general relativity that was first written down by Einstein. So that's what we call the classical theory of gravity, in order to distinguish it from quantum theory, which we'll be getting to. And what you see here in this beautiful illustration, of course, that's not real space, but you see this is a picture of a simulation where two very heavy stars circle each other, kind of before they fall into each other, and they give off kind of a gravitational wave. And that is a dynamical a phenomenon that is also described by general relativity. And we're looking currently with gravitational wave detectors, they're trying to pick up such signals. They haven't quite managed yet because they're extremely, extremely weak. But everyone believes they are there, and, well, we should be seeing them any day. Now, but that's not my worry. That's not my length scale. So, of course, this is not the end of the story, because otherwise I wouldn't be standing here in front of you. Now, why is this not the end of the story? Einstein's classical theory is really, in a specific way, incomplete. So it cannot, in principle, answer all questions we can ask about space and time, about space-time, rather. So which questions can it not answer? Let us go back to the image I started off with, the image of the vastness of the physical scales. Now, where do we know that general relativity gives a very, very good description? We know that this is true for the very large scales, so the astrophysical, the cosmological scales. So that was on the right branch of my length scale. And really there, GR, general relativity, I should rather say, is very, very well tested. And we can even test the theory, or at least aspects of the theory, down to about a millimeter range. Now, what happens below that? Well, of course, then we run into phenomena that are on an atomic and subatomic scale. Now, what about gravity there, gravitational forces? Well, seemingly, they are entirely unimportant in that range of length scales. Why is that? Well, because there are other fundamental forces, namely the electromagnetic force, and then the weak and the strong nuclear forces, which are so much stronger than gravity that, well, gravitational forces are seemingly totally unimportant there. So, and this holds really all the way to kind of particle accelerator scales and Foursome scales beyond that. So there's apparently no real trace of gravity, and we don't have to worry seemingly about gravity. However, of course, you can ask yourself, now, the gravitational forces are so much weaker. Now, how does this story continue when we go to even shorter scales? And now one has to backtrack a little bit and say, well, all these other fundamental interactions I've just mentioned, they are, in their essence, they're not classical theories, they're not described by classical equations of motion, but they're quantum theories. So that's kind of a general rule which we seem to understand about physics, is that any self-respecting theory is really a quantum theory. Now, what means a quantum theory? What's the difference between a quantum theory and a classical theory? Well, I illustrate it here by this picture, these two kind of sketches that pertain to atomic structure. I've taken a helium atom, so that's a very simple atom. So it has two protons and two neutrons in its core. And you see, it has two electrons. So the electrons are, of course, electrically negatively charged. The protons inside are positively charged. So overall, the thing is neutral. And there is something one would call the classical model of a helium atom, where you have this positively charged core. And then you have your two little electrons. They zoom around, you know, like planets on orbits around this core. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't give one a very good and accurate description of the helium atom or any other kind of atom for that purpose. Now, why is this? Well, because exactly you come to very, very small scales where you cannot apply any more kind of the intuition you have developed on much, much larger scales of things being in a precise place with a precise velocity, you know, at any given point in time. Quantum theory simply doesn't work like this. So a much more accurate and better description, it turns out, is the one that's given there on the right. So you still have two electrons. Now, what is now drawn around this nucleus is what one calls a cloud, kind of a probability cloud for these two electrons. What does it mean? The darker the shade of gray is, the greater the probability to find one of the two electrons in that region of space. And that turns out, just to give you a much better description of how this atom actually behaves. So we get substituted exact kind of classical looking orbits where everything is just in, you know, in a specific place at a specific time with a specific speed to such probability clouds of things. And that's an idea we'll also meet again later when we're talking about the quantum structure of space and time. Because we have an idea of what the classical structure of space and time is all about, but when it comes to the quantum structure, we'll expect that, well, it will become kind of quantum fuzzy. So space-time will not be in a specific state of having a specific curvature, but it will kind of quantum fluctuate, just like the position of the electrons in this atom fluctuates. So this is what we are after. Now, the reason why quantum effects for gravity are expected to occur at a much, much, much smaller scale than those, say, for electromagnetism and the nuclear forces is exactly because gravity is just so much weaker. So you expect really kind of the quantum effects to become relevant on a much, much, much smaller scale. And this is exactly what gets you to this exotic and ridiculously small Planck scale. So this is what everyone's been looking for the better part of the last 50 years, a quantum theory of gravity. And just rephrasing what I just said, it must capture something like the famous Heisenberg uncertainty relations that exactly for the case of a particle say, I cannot measure with arbitrary precision its position and its velocity. The two things together, cannot be determined with arbitrary precision. Now, you might ask yourself, okay, what is our expectation, kind of qualitatively? What will space and time look like when I now zoom in with my imaginary microscope to these tiny, tiny scales at and near the Planck scale? Well, people have been waving their hands, like in just the manner I'm doing now, for 50 years, and they have been drawing little cartoons like the one you see here on the screen. So one says, well, obviously space and time cannot be a structureless continuum like we see it, you know, on everyday scales. So it will start quantum fluctuating. And since I told you what is the structure of space and time, well, it's curvature, kind of the way it's bent and curved. Well, we expect that to become subject to quantum fluctuations. So what might happen on very short scales? Well, first you might see some ripples when you zoom in with your microscope, and when you then really, really get close to the Planck scale, well, anything might happen. So people say, oh, space and time are ripped apart, or they develop knots, they develop little wormholes, and all manner of things might happen. Well, and a name for that has been coined in the 70s, I believe, is space-time foam. And, well, this is an artistic expression drawn by one of my students. Now, obviously, we are physicists, and are not content with just drawing little pictures like that. We would really like to understand things quantitatively. So we really want to write down sets of laws that pertain to whatever structure sits there at the Planck scale, from which we can then derive other things, maybe make predictions on what happens on larger scales. And we are also really driven by some fundamental questions that a theory of quantum gravity would hopefully help us answer. Now, here are some assorted questions that keep us awake at night, occasionally. Now, of course, physics has worked, one thing that has worked extremely well in physics is reductionism, you could say. It's sometimes used as a pejorative, but, well, this is really how a lot of physics works. So you try to reduce something you see at a, on a larger scale, some phenomenon, physical phenomenon, to you try to explain it from smaller constituents and how they interact on a smaller scale. And really what one would also dearly like to do for space and time is to say, aha, well, actually, space and time on the smallest scale imaginable, let's say that's the Planck scale, consists of little, let me call them, atoms of space-time, for lack of a better word. Now, let them interact in some simple manner, according to quantum laws of motion, and then let's see whether that can explain what we see and perceive on larger scales. So is this possible? So can we really reduce the problem like of why our universe has the shape and structure it has? Can we really derive this from more fundamental ingredients, laws of motion? So that's really the search for the microstructure of space and time. And so can we explain something like the shape of our own universe, that is so-called the Zitter universe? I'll get back to what this is later on in the talk. Of course, another interesting question is to say, well, maybe we are just made, of course, our human intuition is just made to understand and interact with things that are on our scale, like, okay, 1 meter, millimeter, okay, we can grasp that easily with our intuition. But maybe when I go to something as short as a Planck scale, well, there is no notion of space and time. It's just been substituted by something completely different, which I find difficult to imagine. So is that true? Do we have, are maybe space and time and a notion like causality, are these just emergent properties that only are meaningful on everyday scales and maybe still at LHC scales, but not when you go down all the way to the Planck length? Now, I've singled out, apart from space and time, this notion of causality. Causality is really something that is a principle that's intricately woven into all of physics. In stating it briefly, it just means that cause precedes effect. So for anything that happens now, there was a cause, and that cause was in the past. So there is a definite notion of past, present, and future. And we know nothing in physics that violates this principle. But of course, again, that could be just something that happens to be true on the large macroscopic scales we are able to probe with current technology. Maybe if you go to much, much shorter scales, that will no longer be true. Maybe we can have acausal things happening at the Planck scale. Of course, then the difficulty would be, if you have a model that works like that, to show that nevertheless, what comes out on macroscopic scales is still well in tune with what we know to be true, which is causal, kind of macroscopic physics. Now, more intriguingly, for the lovers of science fiction among you, of course, I might also be interested in perhaps manipulating space and time. And as it will turn out, one really needs to understand quantum structure of space and time in order to be able to do this. So this would in specifically cover a notion like a wormhole or a space-time foam, which I've already drawn. Now, this cartoon there on the right, again, illustrates kind of our qualitative expectations of what might happen to a piece of empty space and time when we zoom into it at the Planck scale. There, above there, you see a little portion of quantum foam. Now, to be somewhat more specific, let us talk about wormholes. Now, what's a wormhole? A wormhole is a structure of empty space-time. So let me define it for you. That's not straight taken from Wikipedia. Has some input from myself. So I give you two possible definitions, a more technical one that says it's a solution to the classical Einstein equations. So it's something that is in principle described by Einstein's theory of classical general relativity. And it describes something like a shortcut. It can describe a shortcut in space-time. That is, a situation like it is illustrated by this figure down here at the bottom. So again, we already practiced a little bit becoming two-dimensional. So our universe, our three-dimensional spatial universe, is here just described by a two-dimensional sheet of paper again. It's flat. Well, you can figure out for yourselves why this bend there on the right is actually not detectable, not visible for the two-dimensional little arm that crawls along there. But that's a different story altogether. Now, this illustrates kind of a region in the universe close to the Earth. So the Earth is there on this upper part of this sheet. And 26 light years away sits Vega. Now, Vega is a very bright star on the night sky, one of our the ones that's closest to us, to our solar system. And, well, one of the closest, a mere 26 light years away. And, of course, if you traveled there by conventional means, it would take you a very considerable time to get there. Now, a wormhole is an ingenious thing. It's the shortcut. Of course, we don't know. It's not known to exist, but theoretically possible. Imagine there was not a little throat which you could travel down very close to Earth, which was much, much, much shorter than those 26 light years. And you came out and, oops, there's Vega just in front of you. Now, that's a wormhole. And, well, the name wormhole is there for obvious reasons. The big question is now, well, this is allowed by, I've stated to you that this is allowed by the classical equations of Einstein's theory, but we are not really aware of such wormholes kind of popping up here and there and having been around for the modern space traveler. Now, of course, now if you want to convince, say, the head of your institute that wormholes are a really, really cool and useful thing to work on, of course, a promotional video can say more than 1,000 words. So I will now take a couple of minutes to show you the beautiful uses of a wormhole, an almost real-life wormhole, in the video that follows. In order for you to appreciate what's being shown, I need to introduce a few elements that are shown in this little movie. So what you'll see is a wormhole. So this is actually the central kind of ball in the middle there. And the green, yellow, orange lines, they are only there to guide our understanding of how space is curved in this specific curved piece of space-time that makes up a wormhole. So you travel down the wormhole, and these lines given by these yellow and green straight, well, almost straight lines, they are the shortest lines in, so where light would travel in this space. And since it's a very, very curved space, the shortest lines really have completely different properties from what we're used from straight shortest lines in flat space. So what you'll actually see in your travel, we'll move into the wormhole and we follow the green lines. If this was flat space, of course, the green lines, they would meet exactly at the center of this yellow cube. But this is a wormhole, so you'll actually see that there will be a sequence of three cubes nested in each other. So the outermost is a yellow one. Then the throat of the wormhole is a cube where you see already its edges are also deformed when you look at it from the outside. And then there will be yet another cube nested inside that orange cube, which is blue. But once we get to the blue one, we'll see we are at the other end of the wormhole. And things look entirely symmetric there. So from there, it would appear that the orange and the yellow cube are actually nested inside each other. Now, these bizarre properties are, of course, only possible because this is a space that is just extremely curved. So it differs just very, very much from flat space geometry we're used to. Okay, now, ready, go. Now, the purpose of this is, imagine you're a member of the astrophysics group in Tübingen University, that's where this movie was made, and well, you're thinking of, it's lunchtime, and you're thinking, oh, wouldn't it be lovely to go to a beach, say, in northern France. Ah, here's our wormhole. Here it is. And you can already see inside the wormhole, you get already a distant view kind of the sand dunes on the coast. But you know, let's have a look around this drab campus, like there are many. Here's our wormhole. As I said, you really, the wormhole itself is this thing in the center. What you see there is kind of the distortions of the light, these rings, they really originate from the very, very strong curvature that this thing has. Now, we are falling into the wormhole. We are following the straight green lines. And the orange cube, you see it's also very much deformed already now, is the throat, the center of the wormhole. Now, we are following it even further. And you see the green ends, they sit perpendicularly on yet another cube. And now when we exit this cube, we see we've reached the other end of the wormhole. So this was an extremely short trip, very handy for lunch breaks. And now we are exiting the wormhole and looking at it from the outside. Well, the beautiful sand dunes, obviously. Now get out your lunch packet. And looking back, we see again the place where we started from. So the university campus. Now we're flying back. And you see now the blue cube is the outermost cube. We're now going back through the wormhole. And we'll stop a little bit now in the plane of the throat. And you see the bizarre thing is that the cube, the orange cube, now lies in a plane. And how can that be? It's a three-dimensional object. Well, this can just be because the geometry is so curved. Now, we're already looking back at Tübingen, well, the ground. We're having a little look around. Here's the building. So we are making a little circle above the throat of the wormhole. There you see again the outer cube on the German end. And the distortions and this upside down view originate again because of strong curvature properties this wormhole has. Okay, one last tour. And back we are. Now, if that doesn't convince the head of your school, then I don't know what does. And of the desirability to be able, you know, to mold space and time like this. Now, here's our little wormhole. Of course, this raises now a number of questions. So, since, well, I presume none of you has recently come across such a nice contraption, the question is why that is. So which part here is fact and which is fiction? So the fact part I already mentioned to you. So the geometry by this is really described as a solution to the classical theory. Now, where's the snag? Well, first of all, the classical theory doesn't describe the birth of wormholes. I mean, how could they come about? If they were not maybe born back at the beginnings of the universe, where could they come from? We have no idea. The classical theory doesn't describe this process for you. Secondly, it turns out that in order to keep such a wormhole open, you need something very, very exotic. You need a very exotic form of energy called negative energy, and you need relatively large amounts of it. And it's negative energy, so that's not a substance we know of, and it needs to have a density that's a billion times higher than that of a neutron star. So the neutron star is really kind of the densest material we know of in our universe, so very, very highly compressed kind of neutrons. Now, here you are asked for a substance that has negative energy, it has a density that's a billion times larger than this. I mean, this is just, forget it. It doesn't exist, right? And also, of course, this energy needs to have also another non-trivial property. It must be such that it doesn't interact with you trying to travel through the wormhole, because if it does, then... So, therefore, well, we can already see a couple of reasons for why we haven't seen many of those around. Now, there is a very, very interesting question that poses itself to physicists. So even if one is much less ambitious, so one might ask, okay, maybe such a large-sized wormhole is not very realistic, let us make it very, very, very small. First of all, let us say, well, let's not worry about where it came from. Let us assume it's just there. Let us make it very small. And could we make it just so big that some tiny light ray or tiny particle could just fly through it? And that would be actually a real big problem. Now, why would that be so? Because as one can show relatively easily with kind of Gedanken experiments, the presence of a wormhole usually implies the ability to travel backward in time. And the ability to travel backward in time, unfortunately, is in conflict with causality. So this beloved principle of causality that apparently all physics we are aware of obeys. Now, why is that so? Well, one way of phrasing it is to raise the so-called grandfather's paradox. I don't really like to use that paradox because there's a lot of unnecessary violence in it. So what is the grandfather paradox? Yeah, imagine you have a time machine, and such a wormhole can serve as a time machine, and you can go back in the past. Now, what can you do when you are back in the past? Well, you take your handgun, which you have at your ready, and you shoot your grandfather before he meets your grandmother. And of course, that is then a slight problem because it seems that you wouldn't be able to be born. You have you have messed up the initial conditions. So there is a logical contradiction that arises there if you want to stick to our standard notion of causality. If there was a possibility to create a wormhole, even the tiniest wormhole, which would enable, like a little particle, a piece of information to sneak through, we'd immediately most likely be in trouble. But very interestingly, you could of course ask, well, is there anything, let us study this problem here closer. Let us try to study this problem with the help of general relativity, because general relativity describes to me how space and time are curved, and it describes to me also these solutions, these wormhole solutions. Now, it turns out no matter which way you're pushing the question, you always end up with a question that cannot be answered within the classical theory alone, because it will involve very, very, very small scales or energies that become larger and larger and larger. And there, well, simply the classical theory is no longer valid, and something else must take its place. And that is the putative and long sought for theory of quantum gravity. So to answer this specific question about is there anything in the nature of time and space that maybe would prevent the existence or generation of such a wormhole, we unfortunately, well, or fortunately for some, must turn to a theory of quantum gravity. Now, I've mentioned to you already various reasons why we would really love to have such a theory. Now, what do we know about quantum gravity? Many, many research grants have been written and granted, but it has proved really difficult to come up with a consistent and quantitative theory of quantum gravity that would answer some or all of these questions, not least, of course, because of the fact that we cannot really, by experiment, probe these very, very short distances. So we definitely, unlike in other theories, we don't have experiment or observations to guide us to what the right theory might be. And that is really a genuine problem here. Now, on the other hand, you might take an optimistic view on this. You might say, OK, I cannot directly look at the Planck scale, and probably in the foreseeable future, I will never be able to do that. Great. That means kind of a free ride, a free lunch at the Planck scale. I just invent my theory at the Planck scale. And who are you to tell me that it's wrong? And you invent your own theory, you cook up some ingredients, you let them interact in some nice way, you choose strings, you choose little billiard balls, and you let them interact in some way, and you just claim this is the correct theory of quantum gravity at the Planck scale. and I would have a hard time contradicting you in general, as long as there are no tools to extract or to extrapolate from some microscopic dynamics you're postulating to exist to what happens on a much, much, much larger scale. So the problem is you cook up your quantum theory on very short scales with your favorite ingredients, and the problem is then how do you really quantitatively extract what it tells you what happens on much, much, much larger scales. So you have your piece of quantum fluctuating space-time, and what you want to do is then kind of zoom out, you know, with the resolution of your microscope and look at it from a distance and then say, aha, that really reminds me of our space-time continuum, which we see around on large scales. So that's, of course, something you want. And unfortunately, there are not so many tools available that would enable us to do that. So really, I would say even, I mean, the sociology of this subject of scientific inquiry has been to some extent dictated by the lack of direct experimental evidence to guide us, and even the lack of being able to predict what your own model or theory predicts to happen on large scales. But fortunately, we have been introducing and using for about the last 10 years some computational tools that to some extent enable us to extract macroscopic information from microscopic models. And, well, I term that that kind of movement or that kind of set of ideas that people have been following in recent years, I term that a new conservatism in quantum gravity, because the aim there is to use really as few ingredients as possible, so to not introduce kind of large arbitrariness, and then kind of try and extract, at least kind of to first approximation, what do your microscopic models really predict on large scales? And is this at all compatible what we know has to be true, say, on everyday scales? Now, of course, you'd be justified to say, well, how do you go about constructing the theory in the first place? I mean, where do I even start? So the logic of how one proceeds is as follows, or how one ought to proceed, in my opinion, is as follows. So of course, to start with, we have well-established theories that are well-tested and known to work very well on large scales. So first of all, I've talked about general relativity, kind of the classical theory of space-time and how it's curved. And then, of course, we have quantum theory, or more accurately speaking, quantum field theory. So that's what describes the interactions that underlie the interactions of elementary particles, so really kind of most of the physics we are ever interested in, everything apart from quantum gravity. So what one can then try and do is with as few extra ingredients as possible, kind of taking just all the most fundamental principles which we know to hold on large scales and adding as little as possible in terms of postulating new ingredients that should exist and which we haven't seen, new symmetries that should exist and we haven't seen. So trying to be absolutely minimalist, build models at the Planck scale and try to do the building in such a way that it doesn't depend crucially on exactly what ingredients you choose and exactly how you let these ingredients interact. So what you want to have, you want some robustness to your models in order that not some arbitrary input, which of course you had to pull out of a hat, determines what the theory tells you in the end. Because if you had a very, very large choice of initial inputs, say at the Planck scale, and they all give you kind of equally, say, internally consistent models of quantum gravity, well, then you would be lost for choice. You know, there would be such a vast number of theories to choose from then that not by any kind of finite number of experiments you could do in the real world, you would be able to discriminate one from the other. Now, so that's kind of the idea. Keep things simple. And what has also been found is that there is a very strong condition imposed on such models by requiring them to reproduce on sufficiently large scales the physics that's already known to be correct on those scales. And that is Einstein's theory of general relativity. Now, the problem usually being that we don't really know how to extrapolate the macroscopic from the microscopic. But once you are able to do that with certain computational tools, one all of a sudden sees, oh, wow, many of the models that I thought they looked great at the Planck scale, unfortunately, are completely useless because they don't give rise on large scale to the kind of type of space-time we know to be present there. Now, very concretely, how would one now go about constructing such a theory? And that can only be extremely sketchy. And anyway, you know, I don't want this to be a technical talk. I just want to get you the flavor of things one does there. And of course, it's cutting short a history, as I said earlier, of on the order of 50 years of quantum gravity research, where one also has learned from many past failures of things that did not work for one reason or other. So let me now zoom in on a specific way of thinking about quantum gravity that a group of collaborators and myself have been developing over the last more than 10 years by now. And it's a new theory where causality plays a special role, and thus it derives its name. It's called causal dynamical triangulation, was already mentioned in the introduction to this talk. So this is simply, well, the baby needs to have a name, right? And so this is it. And don't worry about the pink. The color is totally unimportant. So what I mean to indicate here is that we are working with kind of sub-Planckian building blocks. They are just imagined. I mean, you don't believe that space is made up from these building blocks, but they just help you to construct this curved quantum fluctuating space-time structure. So triangles or higher dimensional generalizations of triangles turn out to be very versatile for doing that. And as an aside, that's of course familiar to anyone working, say, in the movie industry or with animation. One knows that curved surfaces, say two-dimensional surfaces, are very nicely approximated by gluing together little straight triangles. So we're doing the same thing for four-dimensional curved space-times. We glue them together from little flat, straight building blocks in such a manner to create all kinds of wildly curved space-times. Now, we glue these building blocks together to get curved space-times, and then we let them interact according to some simple laws. But the laws have to be quantum laws. So they introduce also this kind of quantum fuzziness. So you can no longer say, well, my space-time has this curvature. It's not true. It has a quantum fluctuating curvature, and it's kind of a probability cloud of things happening. So that is very much like what I showed you, illustrated to you, in terms of this cartoon of the helium atom. Now, what's now the great ingredients that helps us to make further progress from this microscopic model is that we have a computer that allows us to extrapolate kind of what happens macroscopically. So we have these many tiny, tiny building blocks interacting in a very complex manner, although according to very simple laws on small scales. But what you really want to understand is their collective behavior on larger scales. And it's very difficult. It's something you cannot really do with pen and paper. So you really need to simulate these systems on a computer. And the computer is great. It cannot do everything for you, but it can give you a very good idea of whether the model you're working with is a complete failure or has perhaps a chance of being true or partially true. Oops. Now, so the big question is, if we switch on the dynamics, we have these microscopic ingredients, we switch on the dynamics, we let the computer work out what happens macroscopically, well, what do we get? Now, let me go back to my wormhole theme, because now we have a quantitative way of verifying two different hypotheses. One hypothesis is wormholes are allowed to exist, microscopic, little wormholes. So those are the ones I was interested in. I mean, what is the nature of space and time like on microscopic, on very, very short scales? Maybe are these wormholes that are classically kind of forbidden, maybe can they exist? Does that make sense from the point of view of the quantum gravity theory? Or alternatively, does it not make sense? So what I do is I set up two experiments. Well, I let my experiments, I choose the initial conditions, I choose the initial ingredient, and I let the computer work out the consequences. So, experiment A. I use microscopic building rules for my little triangular building blocks. Again, they could be squares, they could be pentagons, it doesn't really matter. And the building rules are chosen such that wormholes are both allowed to exist and to be formed. And they can be of any size. So it's not that I put the wormholes in, but I make the rules such that they are allowed to be there. The second alternative experiment, I do everything the same, but I disallow for the formation of such wormholes. And now, let quantum fluctuations run their course. Here on the right-hand side, these are examples of pieces of space-time with wormholes, so it's just these handles. And of course, the handles can become very complicated. If you have lots of wormholes, they have handles over handles over handles. So that's a piece of space-time with many, many handles. So what happens? Well, what happens is really quite a big surprise. So you might have thought, well, when I allow wormholes, that will really make my space-time really interesting, right? Not saying having the time travel, you know, at the back of my mind. But instead, what happens is that only if I forbid the wormholes altogether, things are still very, very dynamical in quantum fluctuation, but they are not allowed to form. Only in that case, on large scales, do I find a space-time that resembles the four-dimensional space-time that we expect to find on the basis, well, not just on general relativity theory, but on what we see around us. Now, and kind of miraculously, kind of the collective behavior in that case, if I don't allow these wormholes, of these building blocks, which I have such trouble kind of describing exactly, but nevertheless, you know, the computer tells me about, the collective dynamical behavior of this give rise to an extended four-dimensional quantum universe. So that's great. Now, you might, of course, say, well, now, what goes wrong for the case of the wormholes? Well, the interesting thing is, one way to think about this is, as soon as you allow wormholes, really, I mean, any tiniest piece of space-time wants to curl up and become its own little wormhole. So if you add more and more kind of space-time volume, more and more and more, it doesn't contribute, if you allow for the formation of wormholes, to kind of the growth of what I call the mother universe, kind of this extended thing that you want to have in the end. But on the contrary, it will just create a little handle connecting two other handles. And all that will happen is you add more and more and more and more space-time volume, and your universe will never grow. It just becomes a tightly kind of knotted ball of wormholes over wormholes over wormholes. It will never grow. And this tiny, tiny space has a very bizarre property. Namely, you're basically in one step, you're everywhere. So, and that's the property of a space with a very, very large dimension. So something to ponder when you're under the shower. Very bizarre. Okay, now, it's very, very sad news for the science fiction aficionados. I'm not claiming this is a watertight argument, but it turns out to be rather generic. So, I mean, these wormholes, I suspect they're just not there. So, it shows you kind of the usefulness of being able to study these things quantitatively. Even if you cannot do it pen on paper, you use the computer to extract some information without which you would have never been able to understand this. It's a phenomenon that's not easily understood. It's very far away from classical physics. Now, so the wormholes are ruled out for the moment. Now, what then does the theory without wormholes, what does it give me? Does it lead to something sensible? And of course, the answer is yes. Now, I call this the self-organized quantum universe just circumscribing our ignorance of exactly how it happens that these fluctuating microscopic building blocks generate this nice large shape. Now, what we find is that the quantum universe we have created very directly in the computer has the shape of, again, a solution to the classical Einstein equations that is well known, a well-known so-called cosmological solution, and it is the de Sitter space-time that already came up when I talked about classical space-times. Now, what is the de Sitter space-time? De Sitter space-time is really a space-time that if you look at any piece of it, it expands at an ever-increasing rate. So it's kind of the expanding universe, but the universe expanding, accelerated the expanding universe. Now, how can you detect that? Well, if you have stuff sitting in the universe, you know, like stars, galaxies, solar systems, they will be pushed apart by the seeming force or energy that underlies this process, which is often called dark energy. So the de Sitter space is really the simplest solution to the classical equations of motion, which contains a cosmological constant, which is kind of interchangeably used for this mysterious dark energy. So what comes out of our computer simulations is a macroscopic spacetime that has exactly the shape of a de Sitter universe. And what is, of course, and the de Sitter universe really describes our own universe, at least in the distant future, as far as we can tell very well, and also, but also kind of closer to the beginning of the Big Bang, where you also had a region in time where you got such an accelerated expansion. So it's really very, very physical. Now, well, that's great news, and the first time that this has been derived from nothing but first principles. Now, of course, you might ask, all right, but all you've been doing is kind of rederiving the classical theory. You know, I told you that it's already a great deal, but you'd like to see more. You want to understand the genuine quantum structure of this object I've created there. Now, we have started making measurements, making experiments on this thing that sits in our computer, right, as a bunch of zeros and ones, and one really has to work hard in order to understand what its properties are, what its geometric properties are. And one thing we've been able to establish is something rather bizarre, that if you look at it on very, very short scale, so that's really where the Planckian physics comes in, it's no longer a four-dimensional object, but it's something that's effectively two-dimensional. So it's not a flat sheet of paper or anything like a classical geometry, it's more something like resembling a fractal. And people, you know, here who've heard or played around with fractals, they'll also know that these fractals, they are not like classical objects. So, for instance, they can have dimensions that are not even an integer, 1, 2, 3, but they can have a dimension of, you know, 1.387, something like this. So they are very bizarre spaces that have nothing much to do with classical geometry that have such properties. And apparently what we find here on very small scales for our quantum spacetime is just something like this. Of course, work is ongoing to establish quantitatively exactly what this stuff is and how we might, from understanding its microscopic structure, hopefully derive how, say, a light ray will behave in such a medium or how a particle will behave in such a medium and pick up possible effects of this quantum structure, so that ultimately we'll be able to tie this model to genuine observations or experiments. Now, this brings me almost to the end of my talk. Here's some final thoughts. What is maybe most surprising, and of course for me as a scientist most rewarding in this subject, is that we really have started making quantitative statements and kind of predictions within a specific but rather robust framework. And of course we cannot experimentally probe the Planck scale, but we have kind of a poor woman's substitute which is kind of the for an experimental lab, and which are these computer simulations by which you are able to extract very non-trivial information about the system, which has direct bearing on beautiful and interesting questions like, do wormholes and time travel exist? Of course, this comes with a big health warning, namely that really all current theories of quantum gravity that people are working on currently, apart from having to be shown to fit in smoothly with the classical theory, still, of course, have to be corroborated eventually by observation or experiments before they will be accepted as, you know, part of the physical, our physical understanding of the universe. Now, the theory, my pet theory, my baby, has a very nice property that for the first time, one has been able to show that from nothing but kind of pure quantum fluctuations, one can actually create, well, in a way, kind of explain macroscopic behavior that we are used to, that we have seen in the classical macroscopic theory of general relativity. And again, very rewardingly, that has served as an input for other people to go and look in their own models and theories of quantum gravity, whether they can re-derive some of these results. And the result of the two-dimensionality on short scales, for example, has been now corroborated within a number of other approaches. And in the best of all worlds, it would, of course, mean we are all on the right path. Now, if that hasn't quite overwhelmed you enough, I recommend you a nice popular article on the subject we've written a couple of years ago, which has appeared in the Scientific American. More stuff you'll find on my website. And if you want to travel again through the wormhole and look at other really interesting and beautiful visualizations of relativity, there is the website I'm giving there. And that's me here forever staring through my microscope, looking at the structure, the quantum structure to be understood of space and time. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Lowell. We will now turn to the audience for some questions. If you have a question, just please raise your hand, and we have two microphone runners that will track you down and allow you to ask your question. So I think right here.
Hi, I came here through a thunderstorm, so I'm quite excited to be here. It was a great lecture. Thank you so much for coming too. So my question has to do with fractals. I'm a fractal cosmologist, and I notice that you're not afraid to use the F word in this theater.
What word?
You're not afraid to use the F word, fractal, in your theory. So my question is, how important do you think fractals are to the study of cosmology?
Yeah, that's a whole different question, of course. Yeah, people have tried to establish whether, say, in the matter distribution we see around us, there is some fractality. Yeah, that's not my expertise. I'm very intrigued that fractality comes in, but it's an entirely different fractality from what, you know, we see on the very, very short scales for empty, this kind of empty space and time we're studying at the Planck scale. So I don't see any immediate relation, but of course there are technical tools, you know, studying fractality and studying kind of characterizing quantitatively fractality that one can import, you know, from one to the other.
At the back.
Question from the media, Bob Wahlberg from Blunt FM, Toronto. Dr. Roesler has talked about his concerns with the creation of mini black holes at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. And he's put out a proposal and of his concerns to his colleagues around the world, and he's been largely ignored. Could you comment and tell me why he may be being ignored, please?
The reason why he's being ignored. Well, where should I start? These models kind of that are behind, you know, the possible existence of such mini black holes, they are not of the minimalist type I've described to you here, and that is in part what makes them dubious, right? So what I So from my point of view, if you really want to stick kind of to a minimalist series, then the question never arises. So you need kind of the part of the paraphernalia of extra dimensions in order to come to these objects. And of course, it's anyone's guess how likely this is to be true or there.
Why don't they test him, though? Like, he hopes he's wrong. He's actually gone on a lot of interviews, including our station, saying he hopes he's wrong. And he's using Einstein's equations. I'm not an educated person, so I can't sit here and talk with you. But why won't people bring this to a public forum like this and challenge it? Because if he's right, it's a serious problem for all of us.
Well, I think it's more a sociological issue of how you treat someone like this who is not in tune with what we how we judge, what we judge to be true and right. I mean, I think it's less a problem of physics, but it's, of course, some incalculable probabilities. What's the probability of that exotic theory that you need in the first place to be right? Probably for all practical purposes, zero, but for our scientists, it's 0.000001. And that's very difficult to bring across, that this is zero. It's very difficult to bring across to an audience. I mean, one could say very many things about this. I mean, I'm not familiar with the current twists and turns this story has taken, but it was, I should say something good. A case was thrown out in the German courts of a complaint that came from someone who wanted to interfere with the building of this in Switzerland. So that was thrown out on grounds that it is far away from acknowledged kind of scientific consensus. So here's a counterexample of what can happen.
There's another question in the middle there.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Lal. My question is, what is the physical composition of quantum fluctuations, and at what scale does it occur at? Does it begin at 10 to the negative 35, and how?
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, what does it consist of? Now, that's a really hard question. I mean, the question is, what is empty space and time made of? It's already the question you can ask kind of classically is, well, what is it, when you have a gravitational wave, what is it that's kind of moving? I mean, we all want that, for our mental image, we want there to be something. And that's why we are so attached to ether theories. Right? There is a wave, but something should be moving, like a water wave. But you could already kind of classically ask, what is it that's moving? And there seems to be nothing there. Does the question change when we go to very short distances? Well, ultimately, we don't know. We don't really know whether we can ascribe, some geometric entities. It's presumably more abstract than this on very short scales. Probably we are being misled by our very macroscopic intuition. There doesn't have to be anything, material there for sure. It might be some form of energy. So it clearly, when space-time moves, like also in the gravitational wave, there is no matter there, but there is an energy content of that. So that raises an interesting question of, could something like dark energy, that's an energy we attribute to empty space and time, could that be attributable to some kind of quantum fluctuation, some quantum motion of whatever that something space-time is? And that's a question, one is certainly looking at, but we don't have an answer for quite yet.
Time for two more questions. One here.
Once again, Doctor, thank you for coming with us or coming here today to share your knowledge with us. My question is, what are some of the tangible applications for studying this quantum gravity and studying things on the Planck scale? Not that there's anything wrong with knowledge for the sake of knowledge, but are there any real world applications with technology or anything of that we could see in the possible future?
Yeah, that's very, very, very far off. That's just the honest answer. I mean, people have started more focusing their idea of what might be potential observable consequences of that theory we don't even know. So one is starting kind of racking one's brains, well, what must it be? There must clearly be very large scales involved in order to kind of to magnify these processes that putatively take place on very, very, very small scales. So, you know, ideas that people have played around with is, you know, a light ray reaching us kind of from the edge of the visible universe. Can it pick up its, in its motion towards us? Is there some cumulative effect from some non-trivial microstructure of space-time? Perhaps.
And the last question.
Thank you. I had a question. I'm not a physicist, but I'd like to know, what is the current theory as what gravity is? What produces the gravity that we experience on Earth? And then the second part of my question is that you mentioned at quantum level, the gravity is very low. Well, I'm thinking that as we can generate zero gravity. So in the magnitude of size, when you mentioned 10 minus 35 to the scale of 10 to the power of, how do we have a magnitude of gravity that we can use to measure what the gravity magnitudes we're looking at macro and quantum?
Okay, yeah, of course, everything is really relative. I mean, to your first question, do we really understand, you know, what gravity is? Well, we don't really yet. I mean, for example, what we cannot do, what we haven't been able to do yet, starting from these microscopic models, is to rederive Newton's law of how two massive bodies attract. You would say, well, but this is extremely elementary, right? That's something you should expect to be able to get out. That is, turns out to be very, very difficult to describe with the means we currently have, but it's certainly something we are trying to understand. And that would then maybe give a one level deeper understanding of what gravity is all about. But of course, you know, it's only one level deeper, and well, the buck has to stop somewhere. So you could then ask, now where, you know, what is the origin of these, say, quantum gravitational laws from which then the classical ones are derived? As for the weakness of the gravitational forces, well, they are causing us already a lot of trouble, as I've said. So these quantum fluctuations, you know, when I say they are large, of course, this is a relative notion. They are large on these tiny, tiny, tiny scales. So in reality, things are still extremely weak, and they really, yeah, lead to the conundrums in terms of, you know, try to construct a theory that accords with that reality, which we really cannot test properly. Yeah, I hope this answers at least some parts of your question.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Lowell one more time.